good afternoon. This is Dr. John Pinero, and you're listening to Faith and Reason. Thank you for tuning in to Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, and Battle Creek. For the next hour, we're going to do what we normally do on Faith and Reason, and that is we're going to enter into a conversation with a single guest and draw upon the Catholic intellectual tradition and see if we can't know our world better and ourselves better and hopefully alleviate some problems that exist in our current culture. But ultimately, the Catholic intellectual tradition exists to save souls, the same reason the church exists. And so our guest today is Judge Joseph Scoville. Judge Scoville is a retired justice and a judge, and I think of quite recent retirement. And so hopefully he's enjoying his retirement. He was on the bench for 26 years as a magistrate judge in federal court. And before that, he practiced law, during which time he also argued one case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Scoville is a cradle Catholic and a parishioner at Sacred Heart in Grand Rapids. And in fact, at Sacred Heart Academy, he teaches an enrichment course to homeschoolers. So some of you might be familiar with Judge Scoville, and I think you've probably given a few public talks during the Fortnight for Freedom or in other places, if I'm not mistaken. Judge, welcome to Faith and Reason.
Thank you very much, John.
So I thought what we could talk about today is something you and I had discussed off the air, and that is that we have a culture today in America, and we could probably extrapolate and talk about Western Europe and all the remains of Christendom in some way, but we'll just try to stick to American culture. And a lot of us, maybe including you, including me, we operate according to a lot of principles and beliefs that sometimes we don't really think through. And it's hard to think them through, I think, in today's culture, because we not only are we busy, there's a lot of distractions. Electronic distractions. We want things quickly. I see this in students at Aquinas College. One of the things they have to learn to do is make time for reflection, and they're just not used to doing that. And we're not all successful at that, adults or students alike. I think it is an acquired skill. So the philosophical underpinnings of the modern secular state are what I'd like us to talk about today, and we'll just be comparing them to the church's view. And I know you have some very incisive thoughts on this, including the consequences that we can see in Supreme Court decisions. There was that old book by, Richard Weaver, Ideas Have Consequences, but he wasn't the first to say that. But I think he's absolutely right, and I think ideas certainly do have consequences. And one of the questions out there is, how consequential can they be when we're not even aware of them? But let's start with the good and the true. Let's start with the Catholic teaching. Let's start with the Christian anthropology, that is the Catholic view of what man is and how we're supposed to live, and that's going to tell us what a state should be like. Okay, that's going to tell us what government should be like, what it should do, what it shouldn't do. And then we'll put America on the other end of the scale, and we'll see how it goes. How does that sound?
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Pinero. And first of all, let me say what a privilege it is to be here today at Catholic Radio. I'm a supporter of Catholic Radio and think it's a wonderful ministry. And thank you for your Faith and Reason
program. Thank you very much.
I know a lot of people listen to you, and so it's a great privilege to be on your program. You can start just about anywhere on this question, but I'd like to start with St. Thomas Aquinas, who really synthesized the thinking of the church. And as we all know, Aquinas relied heavily on Aristotle. He really baptized Aristotle and made it his project to show how Aristotelian philosophy supports Catholic truth. He went back to the teachings of Aristotle, who said very significantly that everything has an end. We call that teleology, that there is no creature without what he called a final cause or an end, a purpose. And to determine the nature of any substance or creature, you inquire into its final cause and ask yourself, what is good for that creature by answering, well, if it promotes his attainment of his final cause, of its final cause, then it's good for it. And if it doesn't, then it's not. So as he looked at man, Aristotle realized that man was the only rational creature, at least on earth. And this is what distinguished man from animals. So Aristotle asked the famous question, why would anyone want to live the life of another creature? Why would man want to live the life of an animal, an irrational life? So man's final end, according to Aristotle, his goal was to live the life of reason, what he called the good life, a life full of contemplation, as you mentioned, of rational discourse with others, and a life of virtue, where the reason controls the passions, so we're not acting like animals. So this is really quite a beautiful vision for the human being, as far as it goes.
And this is so Aristotle, we're talking about a pre-Christian philosopher then, who through reason alone is discerning this. And so just to make sure I understand, so he's saying that the unique things are how we're going to understand something's final cause, right? And so the unique things of man are his ability to contemplate and to reason, but also to grow in virtue. So presumably, I get if we were to take, let's say, I see squirrels outside the window here of Holy Family Radio. I see trees. If we were talking about an acorn, I recall Dr. Pastana saying once, well, we know what its final cause is. It's to be a tree, right?
And, that's right.
Squirrels, they gather up food for the winter, and they may not remember where they put it, but that's kind of their goal. Their goal is survival. So the beasts procreate, and they're concerned with food, but there's not really an ethical dilemma if we're talking about a cheetah chasing his or her food in Africa, right? They're not there's no vegetarian cheetahs because of some dilemma on whether or not they should kill the gazelle.
Well, that's right, and that's because they're not reasonable creatures. They act on instinct. So there's really no question as to what they do. They have no choice in what they do. They don't have free will like human beings. So Aristotle said that the final cause, the end of animals, was life. But the end of man was the good life. As I said, the life governed by virtue and reason. And it was the Greeks, Aristotle and others, who identified what we call the cardinal virtues, prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. The church teaches that these are the virtues that God gives everyone, even pagans, to help them live a good life. So Aristotle identified these cardinal virtues that were necessary for man to reach his final end. And then he asked himself with regard to government, well, what is the point of government? And again, being a scientist, an observer, Aristotle saw that man naturally forms groups. The first group and the most necessary group being the family. And the family is natural to man because it's necessary for man to reach his final end. That man can't do everything alone. Especially, number one, procreate. The species can't go on to the future with just one person.
Which sounds obvious, and yet, well, maybe we'll get to some disagreement with this later that people in our culture have in terms of the family is natural, or is it what we can make of it or declare in law, that kind of thing.
Right. So in Aristotle's terminology, something is natural if it facilitates your attaining of your final cause, of your end. So it's natural for a knife to be sharp. A good knife is sharp. A bad knife is dull. That's how we know the difference between a good and a bad knife. Is it a virtuous knife? A virtue of a good knife is sharpness. So just like knives, men have virtues, and there are things that are natural to men. And, of course, when I say man, I'm talking about human beings, men and women. I tend to be a little old-fashioned in that. I hope I don't get in trouble here. And he saw that the family was natural to man because man cannot live the good life, the life of reason, the life of nobility, alone. He needs to be in communities. He needs to be in the family, in the clan, the extended family, what Aristotle called the village, and then the largest group that Aristotle saw in those days, in the days of the Greek city-state, was the polis, the city-state, which he saw as aimed at the highest good, the good of all. So the individual's final end is to live the good life. The family's final end is to help the individuals in the family live the good life. And the final end of the polis is the common good.
So that even when Aristotle comes down to us with this saying that man is a creature of the polis, or a political animal, so by nature we're social creatures, we see this in nature because it takes two to procreate, right? And we can't give birth to ourselves either. The individual, there's still a concern for the individual here then. So that the society does it in Aristotle, does the society, the group, outweigh the individual at all? How do we see the balance of individual and community?
What an insightful question. There's a big debate among Aristotle scholars, of which I am not one, on that very question. And the way they put it is the state for the man or the man for the state? And in various places in the Nicomachean Ethics and in Aristotle's Politics, you can read him as saying that the individual really exists for the good of the polis, that the good of the polis is something above and beyond the individual good. And in other places, other scholars say no, that man is at the center of this and that the polis exists for man to live the good life. So I would say that probably he's a little ambiguous on that, but ultimately he comes down, the balance comes down towards the state in Aristotle. I think a fair reading of Aristotle says that the good of the state comes first. And I think we would all agree that in some circumstances it does. In a time of war, for instance, where all able-bodied people are needed to defend the state, that many are sacrificed. And it's not very good for them to be shot and killed in war, but they're doing this for the greater good, for the common good. So that balance, by the way, is what Aristotle says is the job of political science, which is the highest of the sciences, because it is it's concerned with how you balance the good of the many versus the good of the one. And in Aristotle's view, only the philosopher king can do this. Not everybody is cut out to even be a citizen. And this is another controversial part of Aristotle.
He believed in natural slaves?
Yes.
He?
Okay. Yes, he did. He believed some people were born to be slaves, and they didn't have their reason wasn't good enough for them to be citizens. So the polis is made up, the matter of the polis is its citizens, which is not necessarily coextensive with all the people living in the polis. He also said women and children needed leadership, and we're not fit citizens. So Aristotle, we've never canonized him. And as modern Catholic thinkers have said, it really took Aquinas and the Christian view to straighten Aristotle out a little bit by focusing on the dignity of the individual. So certainly by the time you get to modern Catholic thinking, the state is not be all and end all, and the state is for the man. The state is natural to human beings because it helps them flourish and ultimately reach their natural, their final end. But when we look at Aristotle, we see he calls man the rational animal. So man is able to know the good through the exercise of reason. There is such a thing as the good. There is such a thing as the good life. And Aristotle says it's not a matter of opinion. It's not a matter of a vote. It is an objective fact. The good is a fact. Now, this is something that we would certainly agree with.
Yes. And those who don't, so skeptics, for instance, this is a choice for, I think, it's a choice of a type of slavery by saying, I can't know the good, so I'm just going to, I am going to live like an animal then. Because if you think you can't know the good, your other choice is to live for today.
Right.
Right. And to live, in other words, like the non-rational animals do.
And we'll get to that guy in a minute. His name is Thomas Hobbes.
Good. Another Thomas.
Yes.
The one Thomas. Now, Thomas Aquinas, we've canonized. Thomas Hobbes, not so much.
Right. So Aquinas takes this this Aristotelian view where everything has an end and everything has a nature, and the nature is discernible. And there is a good that is also discernible by reason. So when Aquinas talks, he's really not talking theology as much as philosophy. And he says that there is a natural law that is accessible by human reason, even outside of divine law and revelation. It's imperfect because human reason is imperfect. It's incomplete, but it's real. It binds human beings, and it's accessible. Governments exist to promote the common good, just as Aristotle said, within the bounds of the natural law. So from Aquinas, we really get what some people call the medieval synthesis of Christian thought and ancient Greek thought, both based on concepts of final cause or teleology, both based on concepts of a fixed nature. A human being, just like a squirrel, just like an acorn, has a fixed nature that can't be changed without destroying the person. Both Aristotle and Aquinas say that if the form and matter of something are divorced, then the thing ceases to exist. So, yeah, you can tinker with your nature by technology. You can fix your bad heart for a while, but ultimately, your nature is what it is, and you really can't change it. So, this is the end result of centuries of Christian thinking through Augustine, who had some different ideas about government, by the way. We can talk about that if you like.
It might be helpful to say one thing about Augustine relative to the state. So my understanding of St. Augustine in the City of God is to say that, so we have these two cities, of course, the City of Man and the City of God, and the City of Man's purpose, I don't think it's to so much to promote the common good or promote human flourishing as it is really just to provide security. I mean, there's just some limited things that state can do, which seems to be a very attractive It's a very attractive idea for the Americans we'll talk about in a few minutes at the time of the Constitution. That is, if you're talking about limited government, well, what are the limits? Well, then you limit it to the only things that it can do, and it can do them better than you. But the government, you're not going to leave moral decisions up to a government like that.
Well, poor St. Augustine lived in a time when the Roman Empire was crumbling. So he didn't assign much value to governments. And in fact, he taught that if man had not fallen, government would not be necessary. The coercive power of government was only necessary because man was fallen and therefore had concupiscence and tended to do bad. Thomas takes a much more Aristotelian view and says that government is natural to man. It's not optional. It is what man does by nature, and that means it is necessary for human flourishing. It's not just to restrain bad men, but also to allow men to live the shared life of reason.
Did Thomas allow for different kinds of government, or is there one kind that he favored? So Aristotle talked of the three types, right? The many, the few, and the one.
Right.
The democracy and the aristocracy. And monarchy,
right.
All rightly ordered, could be beneficial to human flourishing.
Right.
Thomas come down on the side of monarchy?
He likes monarchy, just like Aristotle did. Aristotle thought that the perfect form of government was a monarchy, but the rule by the one, when it's bad, is called a tyranny, and it's too easy for the monarchy to become a tyranny. So Aristotle says, theoretically, it's best to have a monarchy, but practically speaking, probably a government with elements of each works best. So you have a monarch, but you also have oligarchs the aristocracy, who are not hopefully acting like oligarchs, the aristocracy who have some say, and the polity. The good rule by the many is called a polity by Aristotle. When it's bad, it's called a democracy.
Okay. Thank you for the correction.
and he didn't like democracy, just like the founders didn't like democracy.
Right.
Federalist 51, was it? Or 10, one of those.
You have to constrain the people to make them behave, I think, paraphrase Hamilton.
St. Thomas looks at this and says, adding sort of a Christian veneer to this, well, we know that monarchy is good because God is one and God is in charge. So we believe in a monarchical God, and therefore if the world is going to reflect heaven, then that would be best too. But
your monarch behaves like Christ.
Like a Christian prince.
Yes.
But the church has never really, I won't say never, since Aquinas, has not dictated a form of government. The real test for the government is it pursuing its end? Is it trying to establish the common good within the bounds of the natural law? So, as I was saying, we have the system where everything has a nature, where government is not optional. It's natural to man under Aristotelian Thomistic thinking. It is to pursue the common good and to help everybody pursue the good with a capital G, that good which is knowable by reason to all men.
And so for Thomas, of course, that's to find our final causes in God.
Yes.
And somehow the government, the state, that should make that easier and not throw hindrances in the way, not throw obstacles in the way.
I think Aquinas would say that that Aristotle was correct as far as he went. Mm-hmm. To live the good life, the life of reason, nobility, and virtue, is an end, but not the final end of man. It's a means to man's final end, his final cause, and that is to be with God, eternal beatitude. So being a pagan, without any revelation, Aristotle got it about 92% right. As we know, it is necessary to live a good life, not sufficient perhaps for salvation, but necessary for us and good for us. Good for us being rational creatures made in God's image and likeness to live a life of virtue and nobility.
And then good then for others, so good for the common good.
Right.
And I'm Dr. John Pinero. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. We're talking today with the that's not the royal we, by the way. Maybe I should say I, all this talk of monarchy. I'm talking today with retired Judge Joseph Scoville. We've been talking about Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and how the Thomistic view of man as a rational creature is ordered to the living of the good life, and that as Christians we know what the good is and our final cause is in God. So how then will our state be structured? What are the conditions necessary for the virtue to flourish and for human flourishing to take place? But we're just about halfway done with the show, Judge, and let's now – can we move on to the American understanding of these things? We could trace it historically, which, well, I'm a history professor after all, so that's the way I choose to look at these things, and I think it's best because if we want to see how particular ideas can take firm root and have consequences even when people don't know that they're operating according to those ideas as a first principle, then – starting maybe with the, at least with the founders, if we could, or the Bill of Rights and in the Constitution. And I always wonder, I wonder often whether John Courtney Murray was right when he said the founders built better than they knew, and he found a lot of Catholic ideas among the founders and in the Constitution in trying to defend, defend the American way. Or did that Enlightenment liberalism, that radical individualism, was that pregnant with the problems we have now in terms of skepticism and relativism and tyranny? And was that inherent from the very beginning?
Well, I'll take door two, that it was inherent from the very beginning. And I'm sort of intruding on your turf here. But when you look at the founders, obviously they were very, especially Jefferson, they were very influenced by Locke, John Locke, the English philosopher. But you can't really understand Locke without understanding Thomas Hobbes, who was before him. And Thomas Hobbes really rejected everything that we've been talking about. He said that man does not have an end. Nothing has an end. That man is a creature in motion, and he never reaches his final end, and he's always striving for more power. So as each man strives for more power, they clash, and in a state of nature, in a state without government, it is a war of all against all, another term used by him in his book, The Leviathan, and life is nasty, brutish, and short. And in order to control this this striving, that man must enter into a social contract and give up literally all of his rights to the state, to the Leviathan, which then owes nothing to man except to preserve his life. Almost like that Augustinian idea that you were indicating, Hobbes said that when men think that they can access these higher principles, it leads to wars. The common denominator is self-preservation. That was his idea of natural law. You had a right to live. And that's what the Leviathan, the state, has to preserve.
And so that could very well be, you could be a slave and your life would be preserved.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Now, then comes Locke, who's considered to be reasonable because he doesn't take such an extreme position as Hobbes, and says, no, even in a state of nature, men have their natural rights. It's the first time we start talking about rights and all this, mm-hmm. of life, liberty, and property. Even in a state of nature, man has to respect other men's life, their liberty, and their property. So when we enter into the social contract and voluntarily give up some of our rights for the benefits of government, the government must also respect life, liberty, and property. So unlike the Leviathan, which can respect nothing, life, liberty, and property, and especially property for Locke.
So these are rights that predate government, according
yes.
to law.
Yes.
Now
and they're given by God. Locke was not an atheist.
Okay,
believe it or not,
he comes in for attack from a lot of quarters, and I think, you know, the anti-social contract folks, the Edmund Burke and others who would
Leo the 13th,
Catholic and non-Catholic alike would look at Locke and say, wait a minute, I don't remember ever voluntarily entering into a social contract. I don't even recall being born. But I do recall growing up in a kingdom, let's say, or a country. And again, I guess I'll bring in Augustine, who says if we want to trace all kingdoms to their source, all kingdoms are robberies. Meaning ultimately there's this one strong group of people and they expand their territory and laws develop within that, as later thinkers said. This is where states come from, and the quest then for the Christian is to order that properly. If it is natural to us to live in community – I guess that's one issue with Locke then, right? That the posits this really non-existent moment in time where a social contract was somehow made, and it's ahistorical.
Yes, and so does Hobbes. not only is it ahistorical, but the problem is it views man as a radically individual, atomistic being that owes nothing to no one, that is not part of a family and a society. There is no golden rule. There is no love of neighbor. My only law, according to Hobbes, is self-preservation. Whatever else I do, as long as it doesn't kill me, mm-hmm. as long as I'm killing myself, it is ipso facto correct. It's right. Because there is no higher law. There is no higher morality. There's nothing we can access. As I said, Locke is a little more reasonable, and we like the idea that he says that the state does not create rights. Some rights pre-exist the state. And, of course, that's good, but does he go far enough? So the founders drink from this, right? Mm-hmm. And when you read the Declaration of Independence, especially, all men are created equal. That means politically equal. No one has the right to rule. We read those words in a different way now. But when you read the Second Treatise on Government, you see that what Locke was really saying is that all men are politically equal and no one has the inherent right to rule over anyone else until such time as the social contract is entered into and we form a government. So unlike Thomas, who says that government is natural to men and necessary, it's optional. We can live in a state of nature and have this war of all versus all under Hobbes or respect each other's life, liberty, and property, but it's very difficult. Hobbes and Locke understand that.
So this then is where that idea comes from of government as a necessary evil, which is not a Catholic view.
That's
of
right.
Government.
That's right. That in the words of Jefferson, to preserve life, liberty, and property, governments are formed by men. The government isn't natural, nor is it ordained by God, as St. Paul says, but they're formed by men or not. And that when the same men decide that the government isn't meeting their needs, essentially, they have the right to rebel and overthrow the government.
Well, we'll have to move forward here in time quite a bit, because what I would like to get to in a few moments is to talk about Supreme Court cases that can be seen in this light. But quickly, though, so our modern culture and view on these things today, including maybe some Catholics and other Christians, what do you think is the prevailing view in these terms we've been talking about here of liberty and equality, of the balance of individual and community, liberty and order, those kinds of things that even Aristotle talked about balancing, and Thomas said, well, here's the balance, but I guess, well, maybe a la Aristotle, we're talking about a golden mean usually, but not a mm-hmm. perfect balance, right? And the importance of family as opposed to atomized individuals, which is what I recall Karl Marx writing, of course, that the family in this present form of marriage, as you say, quote unquote, had to be destroyed. That you, how do you atomize people? Well, you have to go after the things that are such strong bonds in community. And of course, the family is the strongest bond. So how do you go after that? Well, you go after marriage, he said. But where do you see us today in an American society that historically has been overwhelmingly Protestant Christian and then Protestant and Catholic? And now many people still actually go to church, and if you ask a European, they think we're the most religious people in the world, perhaps outside of the Middle East, I guess. So how do you see things?
I think most Americans have a perfectly Lockean view of liberty, and that means I can do whatever I want as long as I'm not taking your life, liberty, or property. And for the state to intrude on my ability to do what I want, they need a very, very good reason. Because they're impinging on my liberty, which to the American mind is an end, not a means. Okay. It was apparent to Pope Leo in the 1880s that this false view of liberty was sweeping the world. He wrote an encyclical called Libertas, Liberty, in which he tried to teach the correct view of liberty, and that is to do what we ought. Liberty is the freedom to do what you should do, not the freedom to do what you want to do if what you want to do violates the natural law.
And so that's the tyranny test for a government then. Is it preventing you from doing what you ought to be able to do?
That's right.
Okay.
That's a bad government. So a government that says that I can't wear a red shirt on Tuesday is not really violating my rights because I have no right to wear a red shirt. A government says that I can only have one child is violating my rights because I have a duty. Rights flow from duties. I have a duty to, as a family, I have a duty to increase the species.
But in an annoying law, like the red shirt thing, let's just take for example, as Tocqueville wrote, you get enough of those and you're deadened to tyranny, and then comes the big tyranny, right? Then comes the enslavement or in the name of equality, a tyranny. We're going to be made to be equal.
Right. Well, I use a ridiculous example, but the test for government is it pursuing the common good within the bounds of the moral law? And the red shirt law, unless there's a good reason for it, probably doesn't.
And maybe there
test.
Is. Yeah. You know, in gangland, I remember, you know, in high schools because of gang killers in California, and this may still be a law or not, I don't know, but they would, you know, ban certain colors mm-hmm. that certain gangs would wear just to try to keep violence out of the public schools.
But I think most Americans would also agree with Locke and Hobbes that you really cannot agree on the good. That you have your opinion, I have mine, and what's good for you might not be good for me, and what's right for you might not be right for me. So not only philosophically do they not believe that there is something called the good, but there is also nothing called the right. There is nothing that is truly right or wrong until the government passes a law. So I think most Americans are positivists. That if it's legal, I can do it. If it's not, then I can't.
And if the Supreme Court says it's now okay, that's maybe a moral decision. I mean, in other words, the Supreme Court can determine morality because there really is, I guess, no morality.
Well, you can't legislate morality. You can't legislate morality, they say, which of course is the only proper end for a law is to legislate morality.
So we're topsy-turvy then, as Chesterton might put it.
Yes.
It's upside down.
So we can talk about Supreme Court cases.
Sure. Let's. We could do this two ways, and I'll leave it to you, Judge Scoville. You can pick the most egregious one that's just out there in the stratosphere, you think, on these things, or we could trace a little bit of development, and we could start many years ago
I can do both because the most egregious is also one of the earliest, and that's Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, the contraception case, where the Supreme Court first recognized the right of privacy. Privacy in your personal decisions as to whether or not, in this case, to contracept. And this was written by William O. Douglas, who was probably the worst scholar. They say speak only good of the dead, but it's hard when it comes to Douglas. Probably the worst scholar ever to sit on the Supreme Court. He didn't even try.
There's some competition there.
Yes, but in my book, he's number one. He didn't even try to make this seem like law. This is the case that is now mocked for the concept of emanations and penumbras.
Uh-huh.
The court said, and he wasn't the only one. You need five votes to make a majority. That there are certain rights in the Bill of Rights, freedom of religion and speech in the First Amendment, freedom against a quartering of soldiers in the second, in the third, the right to bear arms in the second, freedom against unreasonable searches and seizures in the fourth. And in the emanations and penumbras of this, we get the idea that we have a right of privacy. It's not in there, not stated in there, but it's in the emanations and penumbras. And that right of privacy extends to decisions about what you do, in this case, in marriage. The couple was married, whether or not to bear children. Now, I think most Catholics would agree that the state does not have autocratic authority over the family. And you probably could get to this right of privacy through natural law analysis, but not that right of privacy, not the unbounded right of privacy. You might say, well, The family is natural to human beings. The principal, obvious purpose of the family is to procreate, to bear and raise children, bring them into the world.
I mean, it took Aristotle probably 20 minutes to arrive at that conclusion.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't take a genius right. like Aristotle.
So is there a right to privacy? Yeah, and that means the state can't stop you from having children. But if the state is trying to create a good society, does the right to privacy extend to a right to tell the state, I cannot procreate if I don't want to? Well, you'd probably say no, because that's not natural. That's unnatural. So you could come to, by natural law thinking, limits to the state's power over the family, but they would be much different limits mm-hmm. from the ones that Griswold versus Connecticut created. And the problem is, it's an unbounded limit. Now there is this zone of privacy in the family where I can do what I want in sexual matters. And that leads us to Roe versus Wade.
Okay, before we get to Roe versus Wade, I just want to, you know, it occurs to me then that so often those like, is it O. Douglas?
William O. Douglas.
O. Douglas. So often like O. Douglas, those who say the state can't make moral claims, I mean, that claim itself is a moral claim, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And he's made a moral decision. So this is always the problem, as Alan Bloom says, as Wilfred McClay says in this guide I use for U.S. history for the students at Aquinas, when you scratch a relativist, you usually find somebody who's not entirely a relativist, who has some very absolute ideas. One of them, of course, being that all things are relative, which is a very straightforward statement about an objective reality in that sense. But
you're absolutely right, and it applies to all of Supreme Court or much of Supreme Court thinking. For instance, the principle that there must be a separation of church and state, such that the state may not even acknowledge that there is a God. And by that, the court says, well, we're remaining neutral. Well, a state that says that does not acknowledge that there is a God is not neutral. It's an atheist state.
Right.
So it's the very same point you made, that I'm claiming that I'm being neutral on these matters when really I'm just picking another morality.
Secularism is not neutral. It's its own orthodoxy, isn't it, in all kinds of ways. I would suggest to the listeners that if you enjoy exploring these things through the arts and literature, there was a wonderful television program on for many years called Twilight Zone. And in California, I grew up watching this because it came in on cable at a time when nobody else could watch it, apparently, except in the stations out of Los Angeles. But there's an episode with Burgess Meredith called The Obsolete Man, and this is his dispute with the state. They told him, there is no God. What are you talking about? And he said, God, there's a God. Whether you think there's a God or not is really kind of immaterial to the question. Mm-hmm. And on it goes, but it's wonderfully done, and sometimes I think it's in it's in cinema and, of course, in literature where you can really explore some of these things. But that's just kind of an aside. I wanted to put in a plug for seeing The Obsolete Man. I imagine maybe somebody could get that on Netflix if they don't want to buy the entire DVD set.
Or even YouTube.
Perhaps. Until whoever owns the copyright finds out, I guess. But so you were connecting this right to privacy to Roe v. Wade, which, of course, has more – there's more human lives than the man and the woman. Although the court's going to take a stand on that apparently too. So let's talk about Roe v. Wade in this context.
Well, the right to privacy created or recognized in Griswold versus Connecticut was directly relied on by the court in Roe versus Wade. So this right to privacy, which I said was unbounded and begged for expansion.
And they build on an 8-year-old precedent. This is their precedent, is an 8-year-old case by that time, Griswold versus Connecticut.
Yes, and that's right. Roe versus Wade is the early 70s, 72, I believe. And again, there's very little legal reasoning by Justice Blackmun, who was a Republican appointee. And the basis of the abortion right was really not stated. It just ought to be a matter between the woman and her doctor. again, a higher morality, just not Christian morality or natural law or a morality based on any sort of reason.
Was there any sense in that case, in the decision itself, of humanity or not of the child in the womb?
It's funny because Justice Blackmun takes a seemingly modest position for government by saying, well, this isn't a matter for government to really determine. It's sort of mystical. And again, there is no good, there is no nature, there is no objective morality, there is not even an objective fact concerning what this fetus is.
And if we follow that logic, then we could come full circle to some of the parts of Aristotle that Thomas expunged, which is that getting to everybody from natural slaves to people who aren't quite human, of the Dred Scott decision variety of Justice Taney in 1857. And in fact, I think eventually we might, other Western nations have, in terms of euthanizing particular populations or approving mm-hmm. them, that kind of thing.
It's the slippery slope that we all talk about. And, of course, Pope Paul VI predicted all this in Humanae Vitae when he talked about the effect of allowing contraception on the thinking of people concerning the sanctity of life. If you go back and read Humanae Vitae, which was written in the 60s, the Pope foresaw all this. So it really, and that's sort of my thesis. It's all of a piece. It all depends on your underlying principles and assumptions. Mm-hmm. If there is no good, if we are all atomistic individuals, then what right does the government have to tell me what to do or not to do unless I'm hurting somebody else?
If those premises, as we would say in logic, right, if those premises are true, well, then so the conclusion
right.
is true.
And that is where the Supreme Court is now. The Lawrence versus Texas case, 2003 case by Justice Kennedy, who's Catholic and a Republican appointee, that had to do with the constitutionality of sodomy laws. Now, in 1986, in Bowers versus Hardwick, the court said laws criminalizing sodomy are fine. There's nothing in the Constitution about this, nor is there any long-felt American principle about this. This is something.
Sure, we fought a revolution for that, didn't we? No.
Apparently we did. So in 1986, the Supreme Court said this is just a matter of state law. But by 2003, Justice Kennedy says laws against same-sex sexual activity, are unconstitutional because the state has no reasonable ground for forbidding this. The test the court uses is there a rational relationship between the law and a legitimate or end of government? So the government must justify every intrusion into liberty, especially sexual liberty, by saying there is an important governmental interest here. And the Supreme Court said, in that case and others, that an appeal to quote-unquote traditional morality is not sufficient. So to say, well, Western society has always understood, based on Judeo-Christian principles, that this is sinful, that's not enough. The natural law says that the use of these sexual parts in this way is unnatural, so it's disordered. Can't say that either. You have to point to some governmental interest that justifies it, because we cannot know the good. So we're left with government justifying its actions by saying this is really necessary. So attorneys general who are forced to support these things, to argue for them, well, it's better for children. Well, you really can't prove that. to the court's satisfaction. Marriage between a man and a woman is better for children. They reject that sort of thinking. If you could prove it scientifically, maybe they would give some credence to it. But what you cannot do...
Well, there was a professor recently who tried to do just that and got in quite a bit of trouble, and it was a sociologist who had actually done a study about children in same-sex homes. And I haven't read the study or looked at the data, but I do know, as Father Miss Campbell has written, that in a civil dialogue about these sorts of things, civility would imply that everybody ought to read that and come to a decision based on evidence. So this is what thinking people do if they don't already have their choices made for them before they allegedly think.
Well, these are forbidden thoughts. You can't express these things, otherwise you're being hostile to this oppressed minority.
So we have about 6-7 minutes left on the program. This is Dr. Panera. I've been speaking with the retired Judge Joseph Scoville about not only the Thomistic and Aristotelian principles that inform the Catholic view of mankind and of the state and of government, but also the American view on those things. And I imagine, if polls are correct, that quite a few Catholics, if they do contracept, they must be operating on some of these non-Catholic principles, whether they know it or not. So I'm wondering what can Catholics do to stem the tide, redeem the time, or should we retreat to the hills in little communities and build fences? Mm-hmm. What should we do?
Well, the term Catholics, first of all, is pretty broad. When you understand that, what is it, 30% of Catholics go to church every Sunday, 25% believe in the real presence, it's not surprising that maybe a small minority believe in the church's moral teachings as well. So we have a big job of re-evangelizing our own. We talk about the new evangelization, we should go door to door. What we ought to do is get the old parish list from 15 years ago and go door to door to find out where these people have gone and re-evangelize them. But serious Catholics in the marketplace and in the form of public ideas have a duty to speak up and to speak in favor of natural morality. And this is the great thing about natural law. It gives us a language to speak to non-believers. Aquinas made the point that you really don't have to believe in a God to understand that there are principles of right and wrong that can be accessed by reason. So that would be a great step. Certainly a country based on the principles taught by the church would be perfect. Beyond Malta, there aren't any of those left. So the next best country would be one that says, we understand that there is a good. And that we can reach it by reason, and let's try to do that.
Is that the kind of country we used to have? Even when we had a very Protestant majority that, from time to time, was nativistic and anti-Catholic, and anti-Semitic, for that matter, was there not enough of whether we call it residual Christendom or Christian principles? That even with our founding, which you described as an Enlightenment, liberalism won and Lockean enough that it's kind of we're seeing the playing out of these principles. But as long as there were sufficient numbers of church-going Christians, Protestant and Catholic, it seems like we had a pretty good run as far as countries go. So I think you're right about evangelization, but could Catholics be comfortable even in that kind of a country, or are we called always to push for more?
Well, we had a pretty good run, but so did Rome. and the seeds of its destruction were sown hundreds of years before the empire fell. And that's sort of my feeling about this. But, yes, there certainly was a time in our country where the link between morality and law was apparent. Even when you read court cases from the 1800s, they would sprinkle scripture as Protestant judges. Mm-hmm. They would sprinkle scripture into their opinions because there was no question but they were trying to come up with the right answer according to God's law.
And very few people thought anything was wrong with
it. Nobody blinked. There's a principle of agency law that a man cannot serve two masters. It comes right from the Bible. And the judges who enunciated it in the 1800s didn't rely on anything else except the passage from Matthew that says you can't serve two masters.
No penumbras or
no penumbras
emanating from...
Just a sense of it's natural human nature. If I'm working for you, I really can't work against you at the same time. I can't serve two masters. I have to work for you and that's it. So there certainly was a time, and I think because we were living off the Christian patrimony, that there was a clear link between morality and law. But now we have this idea that you can't legislate morality. Well, that's patently ridiculous on its face. That's all you're supposed to be doing, is finding out what the right is and then putting it into law so that people are encouraged to do the right. Pope Leo XIII, I think this is really interesting, defined law as a fixed rule of teaching what is to be done and what is not to be done. So law doesn't only restrain the will, restrain bad men, but it also teaches us what is good.
So it's like a discipline in the proper sense then. I mean a disciplined
Absolutely.
Person, right? Discipline to one is a disciplined according to the cardinal virtues you mentioned earlier.
If the state has a vision of the good and the good life, then it enacts laws that help people live the good life.
Well, Judge Scoville, I want to thank you very much for coming on Faith and Reason today. It's been a very interesting discussion and wide-ranging, and I hope if our listeners want to know more about some of these cases from a Catholic perspective, and I don't mean simply a very simplified moral perspective, but some of this natural law stuff, where can they go to get that? Maybe a book or a speaker or a series? Can you think of a resource for them?
You should have asked me that an hour ago. So I thought about it. Nothing is coming directly. There's so much on natural law. Robert George writes on it.
Okay. We had Jay Bujyshevsky on the program
yes.
a while back. So those
yeah,
folks would be good resources
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
Okay. Very, very good. And is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? I always like to give our guests a opportunity to plug something, but retired folks, maybe you're just going to plug a retirement. Is
no,
pleasant.
I'll plug Sacred Heart Academy, where I'm teaching an enrichment course, as you indicated, on American government. We haven't gotten to American government yet. We're still mired in Aquinas and Aristotle, and we're about to get to Hobbes and Locke. They have not only a school. A classical education school, but they also have these enrichment classes for homeschoolers, and there are 94 homeschoolers that are there for one or more classes.
So it's a very interesting model then for a school. So they're not full members of the school in that sense. I mean, not full daytime students.
Right. It's a unique model, okay. And it seems to be working.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you once again for being on the program, Judge Scoville.
My pleasure.
I'm Dr. John Panero. You've been listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. Remember that you can go to holyfamilyradio.net, click on Faith and Reason. You can hear any of our past programs, ones I mentioned today. You'll be able to hear this program once it has aired and has streamed on the Internet. Thank you again for listening.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is a professor of history and director of Catholic studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.